Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journeys. So thank you very much, Aparna, for joining me today on the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast.
Thank you, Fergal, for having me here.
Maybe if you can tell us a little bit about Arman, what you do, and maybe the scope and impact of Arman today.
Yeah, so thank you for having me here, Fergal. So Arman is a nonprofit that leverages technology to create cost-effective, scalable solutions to impact maternal and child health in India. So on the one hand, we use mobile technology to create scalable solutions to allow us to inform women about the care to be taken during pregnancy and infancy. We do that through voice calling services, which are bolstered with a call center and a missed call system. And on the other hand, we use mHealth, that is mobile health, to train health workers throughout the country.
Right.
And we do that so that, you know, risk factors are picked up early and treated in time, you know, before it's too late. And so that there's no overcrowding of tertiary hospitals, and overall there's reduction in maternal and child mortality and morbidity.
Right.
And Arman currently works in 16 states in India. We have reached over, our programs have reached over 20 million women and their children overall, including our Mitra program and Kilkari program. And on the other hand, we have trained 170,000 health workers in 13 states in India.
Wow, that's a considerable impact. Can you talk a little bit about the scale of the problem in terms of child and maternal mortality in India, and how you went about understanding what the roots of that are, I guess, which has informed your approach to helping solve some of these problems?
Yeah, so, India has one of the worst maternal and child health indices in the world. India accounts for 11% of the maternal mortality in the world. Two children under age 5 die every minute in India. So you can understand the scale of the problems. And, you know, when I was doing my residency in Mumbai in OBGYN, that is obstetrics and gynecology, I'm currently a urogynecologist. You know, I saw very closely how pervasive systemic problems led to loss of life. And it is very important to, you know, ensure that we take care of the problems at scale and systemically. And if you look at systemic issues, there are three basic reasons why mothers and children die, right? These are called three delays, right? The first delay is lack of access to preventive care information. If a woman is not aware, she's not going to take care of herself and her child. If she doesn't know what danger signs to look out for, what are the risk factors, she's not going to take care. And that's why we have this whole programs using mHealth on informing women about the care to be taken during pregnancy and infancy weekly through voice calling services. And on the other hand, if you look at the second delay is when they become aware that there's a problem. They do not know where to go. You know, there are no ambulances. The roads are terrible. And on the other hand, you have the third delay. The third delay being that when they reach a hospital, you know, the health workers are not trained. Doctors are not, you know, trained enough. There's a shortage of staff. There's no equipment. There is no supply. So you have this three delay model. And I realized that if you want to impact lives, you have to impact these delays. So on the one hand, we have programs impacting the first delay, that is lack of access to preventive care information. And the other hand, we have programs impacting the third delay, in the sense that, you know, we train health workers so that they're able to pick up problems early. There's treatment that is given early enough. There's end-to-end access to care so that women do not end up in a dying state. And our third delay, second delay, that is, you know, not knowing where to go, is taken care of, because once you, a woman become aware of the problems and, you know, and health workers are trained, then there's no delay. So there's no, you know, emergency where, oh, I'm not aware where to go and, you know, I can't get there, because they're taken care of earlier. So we work at impacting systemically.
You've got a very fundamental issue there in terms of the actual communicating with mothers to be. How did that go?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what I realized, you know, is that, you know, women, and I must say this, you know, these women are extremely smart. And that's what I've learned. I hate the word charity, right? These are women who deserve a great, push to their lives. They deserve an impetus given to them. They don't have access to that. These are underprivileged girls who come from pockets of rural, you know, poor India. They've come to urban India. They are, you know, these are pockets of rural poor in, you know, urban slums. And they're illegal settlements. They're married off to husbands they've never met before, or, you know, maybe only met once or twice. And they're divorced from their family community back home in rural India and in urban India. And, you know, frankly, they have no one to speak to, right? So suddenly when somebody comes and talks to you and says, oh, we have this program where we're going to start sending you voice calls. Of course, there was a lot of skepticism. They couldn't believe that, you know, something like this would help them or their families would agree, right? So it took some of the, you know, the first beneficiaries, right? They were very brave to take on the program, right? They agreed to come on board. And what happened is that, you know, once they agreed and started getting the calls, suddenly there was this elder sister voice coming in. You know, imagine, you know, you're so, imagine these women's lives, right? No one to talk to at home. They go to a hospital. It's very apathetic. They have to wait in line five hours in the hot, humid clinics, overcrowded. They're treated like cattle. They're made, you know, made to run here and there. And somebody shouting at them. Suddenly it only just give them get 1 minute with the doctor, right? And suddenly in the comfort of their own homes, they're getting this voice call, right? In a time slot that they have chosen, right? And an elder sister voice in a, you know, very nicely talk to them about so many things that are far beyond anybody ever spoke to them about, right? You know, when these women go to the hospitals, what are they told? Take iron, take calcium, you know, such big picture information, right? And very rudely, right? Because there's no time, no one has the time to give them any information, right? And suddenly a voice call comes in and an elder sister talks to them about, you know, this week you might feel like eating mud, or, you know, the baby is the size of a cabbage inside of you, or the baby is developing nails right now, or, you know, yes, you know, you might be worried about how to have sex during pregnancy, or how to then ensure that you do not get pregnant again immediately after childbirth. These are things no one talk to them about, right? Small and important things that are important to them, but no one cares about them.
And presumably then as it grows, when you've got cases where they're seeing the benefit.
Yes, and then they start getting the information. They loved it, and then they started telling the other, you know, women in the area that you have to enroll into this program. I'm very happy to say that many of our beneficiaries and Mitra have actually become the health workers for us going forward.
Yes, yes. So how many health workers have you trained, Aparna, and how have you done that?
Yeah, so we, in addition to Kilkari, we are in partnership with the Government of India to implement a program called Mobile Academy, which is a mHealth-based, a mobile health-based program to train health workers, the frontline health workers through the country. They're called ASHA workers. So basically, we are in 13 states right now, and we've reached across to 170,000 health workers as of now. And the goal is to reach across to 1 million health workers by 2025. And the way we do it right now is that it's a voice calling service. That is that they can call in. It's 4 hours of content. It is 11 chapters, 4 sections to each chapter. And there's a quiz at the end of each section. And there's a bookmarking system. She can come in and log in and log off, you know, where she's taken off the last, left off the last time. And as I spoke about, going forward, Mobile Academy will go on to create more two-way communication channels. We are going to have multimedia approaches to training these health workers. So we are going to have, you know, WhatsApp support for the health workers. We are going to have remote training. Also, we are going to use, send video content or have a thin app on their phone so that, you know, this content can be stored, right? So there is, you know, more hand-holding and more intensive training of these health workers as they go about their jobs.
A silly question maybe, but what about the fact that it's a recorded message? Has there been any response to that?
No, so you know what we do in our program is that we have our health worker station government hospitals who are enrolling, and we have a partnership with NGO partners whose health workers we incentivize to go home to home in the slums, and we have the ASHA workers in the villages. So their program is introduced to them. So they already told at the beginning of the program, at the time of enrollment, it's a voice call. It's an automated call. However, they also know that they have an access to a call center. And the call center is filled with extremely empathetic, you know, women who are like them, but trained to be able to counsel them, right? So they understand, it's tech plus touch approach. So they are aware of the fact that, right, yes, now it's a voice call, but if I have any query, I can call this call center.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a sense of how many go on to that direct contact?
Yes, absolutely. Oh my God, during the COVID times, we've been in, almost every woman has called in to the call center, literally. And we get 300 to 400 calls a day out of 300,000 women we serve. Live, say in Mumbai, if you take the example of Mumbai, 300,000 are getting Mitra voice calls currently. Out of that, over three, you know, we get 400-500 calls daily to the call center.
Right, right. Presumably, the COVID is as crisis has had a significant impact on the demand for your service.
Absolutely. I mean, I must tell you this. You know that because we had already created the tech platform. Also, the fact that we already had these partnerships in place with the government for Kilkari and for Mitra with the NGOs and the hospitals. You know, we were prepared for COVID, literally. When COVID struck and the lockdown announced immediately overnight, you know, suddenly hospitals closed down, right? They don't have access to care, right? And, you know, there's no public transport. And the containment zones where the slums, where the underprivileged live, they did not know where to go, how to access care. And pregnancy and infancy can't wait for a lockdown. If you need an ultrasound during pregnancy, you need an ultrasound immediately. If you have an emergency, like you're bleeding, you need to go to hospital immediately. But they did not know where to go. So they were getting these distress calls to a call center. So overnight, we created a virtual OPD because we already had a tech platform in place. We could repurpose it. So we created a virtual clinic manned by doctors because the queries then coming in could not be handled by only our counselors. So we had to have doctors. We had 60 doctors. So we had an antenatal clinic and a pediatric clinic. Answering calls, and the clinic exists even now from the last 5 months. It's ongoing. Also, we started sending COVID-related information because pregnancy is a vulnerable stage to have COVID in. So we, in addition to our regular voice calls, we also added COVID information. And we kept on kind of, you know, changing the information. We go back to drawing board. We have a six-week cycle. And again, we go back to drawing board and send the next series of information. So the women are kept up, you know, updated with COVID-related information. Also, I told you that we have this whole health worker training program using technology and mobile health. During COVID, Government of India collaborated with us. And we started sending information related to COVID to 800,000 health workers through the country.
Right. For example,
Government of India came out with a health insurance scheme. How do you tell, health workers? So they collaborated with us. And over, you know, like in a couple of days, we created the content and over 800,000 health workers, the frontline health workers and the doctors got information.
To what extent do you provide family planning information and how does that fit in? It's a very big area. Just maybe touch on that.
Oh, absolutely. Family planning is an integral part of. See, we deal with RMNHCHA, that is reproductive, maternal, child health and neonatal health and adolescents, right? So reproductive health is a big part of, you know, any maternal health program. So for us, our voice calling services to the women directly, or even the call center support that we provide, or even the health worker training program has a huge aspect of family planning in it. And I'll give you an example of the benefit of it. You know, I must tell you a story from the field on it, right? So in Andheri East slums, Andheri is a suburb of Mumbai, there was this wife of a Azan preacher, you know, she was from the Muslim community, and this is a priest, a preacher, right? Who sings the Azan every morning. And, you know, when she got pregnant for the first time, she did not have Mitra. And she got pregnant immediately after the first child, within a couple of months, you know, because no one had told her about family planning. And she herself knew inside that something is wrong here. You know, I told you, these women are smart. They just need that impetus from us, right, to understand. Somebody tell them that what they're thinking is correct, right? But she didn't have access to information or even access to, you know, any friends who could inform her that, yes, she's right. She shouldn't have got pregnant so early. But that time in her second pregnancy, she got access to Mitra. She got enrolled into Mitra. And Mitra came in and it told her that, you know, now that you're pregnant, ensure that, you know, the next child you have after at least 3 years, because you need to have spacing, because your body needs to get healthier before you have the next child. Or if you already had 2 children, maybe you should consider family planning. So when she heard that information, she was convinced that she was right, that misgiving had inside her of having got pregnant so early after the first child was correct. So she convinced her husband and her mother-in-law and the father-in-law to adopt, that she's going to adopt family planning. So a conservative Muslim preacher family agreed to undergo family planning just because Amitra came and told her that no, family planning is important. And you know, I must tell you this very important point here, that like I told you earlier, it's not charity. These women are smart. They know it within themselves. But they don't have somebody to validate that knowledge that they have inside, or that, you know, sense of justice that they have inside. So when a voice call comes in and tells them that, yes, this has to be done, you know, they can stand up. So, you know, you see these women upending family dynamics. I must say this to you that, you know, I'm going to take a minute to say this, right? So the good thing about these programs, I thought as a doctor, I'm giving them information, right? I'm giving them a I'm sending them a voice call. So what will they, what these voice calls will achieve is going to give them information. That they'll have knowledge recall and behavioral change. You know, this jargon that we use, that they will adopt right behaviors. But the most important, you know, benefit of this whole program has been empowerment. What, you know, information is empowerment. You know, you inform women, they stand up, they upend family dynamics, they stand up to patriarchal mores. And, you know, like this Muslim woman who adopted family planning, there are these Hindu women from very patriarchal societies back home in Uttar Pradesh. You know, they have to wear this veil. Some women have given up wearing a veil. I have instances of that in the slums. Some women send a girl child into an English medium school because they realize that, you know, if my child is educated, like I'm getting information, I'm getting educated, I know how to take care of myself. Similarly, my child should be have access to that. So, you know, empowerment that the women undergo, right? The fact that they understand that they have to stand up for themselves, that is intergenerational. They actually go in and support their own children to do better.
That's very inspiring. It's very inspiring. You've got a tremendous medical background, and that's where you come from. Yet again, you've mentioned this question of scalable and technology. Can you talk about why technology is important and how challenging that is to think about, to come up with solutions that use technology, given the infrastructure and environment in which you're working?
Yeah, so technology is very important because, you know, we realized early on that India's scale of problems is so huge that anything we design has to be designed for scale from day one. Right. And if you create traditional models of implementing programs, which depend on, you know, resources, that human resources going home to home, that's creating a parallel infrastructure, right, to the government of India's existing health network. It is very important that, you know, we use solutions that are cost effective, that are scalable, yet, you know, when scale is achieved, impact is still maintained. You know, so when the mobile phone came to India, it is very obvious that, you know, within a couple of years, it spread through the country. It is very easy to use technology that every woman had access to, literally, because if she didn't have a phone on her own, her family would have access to that phone. And it was one more important point was that, you know, women were going to upgrade. You know, it is very obvious that the upgradation of technology also would happen because as smartphones came and became more, you know, cheaper, it is obvious that before long, it's going to spread, you know, through the country. So it became obvious to me that technology was a route to make it, you know, to create programs that achieve these goals, that they are cost effective, that they're scalable, but when you scale up, impact is still maintained. However, we don't use just technology. We use tech plus touch approach, because it's not enough to, you know, use technology to call up women, right? Because you have to have, you know, a personal touch in terms of, you know, having somebody introduce a program. So we have our health workers stationed in government hospitals who introduce our programs to the women when they come for their antenatal care. We have also partnership with community-based NGO partners whose health workers we actually introduce a program in the field, in the slums itself. And in rural India, we work with the government, you know, frontline health workers who are called the ASHA workers and the auxiliary nurse midwives. You have to have that, you know, personal touch there. Also, we also have a call center, right? We have a 30-member call center. The women can call back in for any query that they have. Now, when we improve the tech plus touch approach, it still allows us to use less resources, because the touch points, though we can reach across to women more often using technology through voice calls, or we can train the health workers, you know, easily through, you know, mHealth, then the number of touch points are more. However, the resources required for that is less in terms of human resources, much less in traditional models. Lastly, one very important thing we realized was that you can't create a parallel network. You have to leverage the existing health infrastructure. So we partner with governments, we partner with community NGOs, we partner with hospitals. We partner with 97 hospitals, we partner with 40 community NGO partners and the government at large to create scalable solutions. So we don't have to build a parallel network on the ground. So we are tech plus touch, we are leveraging existing technology, existing infrastructure. And lastly, we also use an evidence-based approach, right? So everything that we do is tested before it's scaled up, it's researched.
Right, very interesting. Coming back again to your background, can you talk a little bit about how you ended up actually becoming a social entrepreneur and what your thoughts were about dealing with this problem when you set out?
Yeah, so, you know, I am a practicing urogynecologist. So I've never stopped my medical practice. In fact, I built Arman or founded Arman during my first year of training at Stanford in the United States, and the first 7 years in the US, I actually built Arman along the way while I was doing my fellowship in Cleveland Clinic. And I have continued that when after coming back to India. So I have a parallel life. But when I was doing my residency in Mumbai, you know, I saw closely how pervasive systemic problems led to maternal and child deaths that are completely preventable. We were seeing horror stories every day, you know, and I realized, you know, that if I were to impact lives, I have to go into the community to prevent those problems, right? And it is very obvious early on that, you know, to do that, I had to kind of, you know, do it in a manner that is not being done already, because traditional models are resource intensive. Traditional models depend upon, you know, using health, you know, workers going home to home, you know, and they're so resource intensive, they don't scale up. And at that time, there are not so many scalable solutions. And those scalable solutions are being created by the big multilateral agencies, right? So Indian NGOs tended to be community partners of those big multilateral agencies. And it was my, you know, intention. I mean, I thought, why not create a homegrown NGO that creates scalable solutions that spread through the country? And I had been an activist all my life. You know, I had worked in a, you know, animal welfare organization as a volunteer. I had worked in an education NGO as a volunteer before I even entered my medical training. And I realized that when I was doing my, you know, MBBS and my residency in OBGYN, I thought that, you know, why wait for anybody else to implement those, you know, solutions? And that's after my medical training. I had actually created a plan to overhaul Mumbai's public health structure, the referral system for another NGO, and learned a lot on the ground, you know. So that's when I said that why wait for anybody else? So along with doing my, you know, fellowship in the United States, I also built Arman. You know, literally burning the midnight oil. You used to get up in the morning at 3. I would get up in the morning at 3, work for 3 hours, 6:30. I would go to my, you know, fellowship, for my fellowship program, come back again, couple of hours. So built it along the way. And here we are.
That's tremendous energy and commitment, Aparna. Fantastic. Now, can we just talk for a moment a little bit about the technology again? It can be a tricky area, technology in the nonprofit and social sector. How did you go about thinking about this? I mean, you mentioned the importance of scalability and also working with partners. Was there a tendency to think about more sophisticated solutions? How did you come up with that kind of sweet spot?
Yeah, so, you know, at the point I built Arman, 2006, 2005 was when I was thinking about, you know, creating Arman. And 2008, I finally registered Arman. At that point in time, technology was not getting used for creating solutions. Also, when technology started getting used, it was all about building new technology pieces, you know, new devices. Right, let us create an e-partogram, right, or create an app, or, you know, I mean, something that required a new device. And, you know, when the mobile phone came to India, and this is like, when I did my residency, mobile phone is just entering India, and within no time, it spread through the country. And I realized that if you use technology, yes, it helps you to create scalable, cost-effective solutions, but it has to be technology that is easily available. It can't be a new device that has to go through the country. Again, then it does not, you know, help, scale. You can't scale such a program. So a mobile phone, you know, went through the country. Like, you know, there are more mobile phones in India even now than toilets, right? So, you know, so it's easily accessible in all parts of the country. And again, as I said, mentioned earlier, it's something that, you know, women are going to upgrade on their own, you know. I mean, a smartphone, you don't have to worry about, you know, them upgrading. You don't have to upgrade your technology, you know, for delivery. They are upgrading and you just keep pace with that, right? So I realized that it's easy to use technology, it's cheap. You don't have to buy phones for the women, they do it for themselves. It is going to upend traditional models, right? And the COVID has shown it, right? You have to build, depend on digital health. But yes, at that point in time, in a way, I was told by most traditional practitioners that it's not going to work, because why is a woman on the field going to give you her number, right? When we went to the field and wanted to have partners, because I realized that not only that you have to use technology, you also build partnerships. You cannot work alone. You have to work through partnerships so that they become the conduits of enrolling women. So when I went to the field, many NGOs kind of were skeptic, you know, skeptical about whether the idea would work, because, you know, you're talking about women who never spoke to anybody else. You know, when you talk about an underprivileged woman in an urban slum or rural India, these are women who have access to maybe feature phones, those not smartphones, especially during those times where they had access to this one phone in the house that everybody used. Maybe they used it to call their mother or their husband. They had never spoken to anybody else. So the idea that, you would create a program where you would enroll these women in the hospitals or in the slums or in the villages, and then they would listen to these calls weekly. Somebody else is calling them. How is it going to work, right? Why will they give you the number? Well, families agree. These are very patriarchal societies. How is it going to work? Similar with the health workers, right? How is a health worker be okay to listening to, or learning on the phone, right? Because these health workers also are similar women from the field, right? Who become health workers. So are they going to access that information, training? So a lot of these questions were being raised. But, honestly, when we went to the field and we started implementing these programs, so on the one hand, we have these voice calling services that have gone through the country. And on the other hand, we have these health worker training program using mobile health. Honestly, the women surprise us. They have not only taken on to the programs, for them, it's almost like they have their friend on the phone, somebody like an elder sister who's calling them weekly, telling them how to take care of themselves. We're getting calls from these women telling us, Didi, like they call them Didi, meaning elder sister, must be getting tired. She has to call me so many times. They don't realize it's an automated voice call, right? And also they have a call center, right? We have a call center they can call up and talk to. So, what has happened is that, frankly, these women never had access to, emotional care, never had access to the answers to small questions that afflict them as much as middle-class women, right? Even an underprivileged woman would want to know how her child is growing inside of her, sex during pregnancy, family planning, questions that she can't ask anybody else, right? Psychosocial stimulation of the child, right? So not just the big picture information. Now there is this voice call coming in, an elder sister is telling her how to take care of these little things. She has a call center she can call up. They've taken up so to the program so much that women are actually going and buying their own phones.
So people were skeptical when you had this idea. So what was your response to this, and how did you literally go about, making this happen, your first steps? And presumably you also needed to think about how this was being funded and was going to be funded. You talk about the very early days.
Oh, very early days were very, very difficult. It took me 4 years, 4 years to get the first penny into Arman. It was very difficult because, I was a student. I was not an established, professional. I was talking about creating scalable solutions in a space populated by the big multilateral agencies. So it took me, really a long while to convince people. But what I did was, the proof is in the pudding, right? You have to actually prove your programs work. So in 2011, with great difficulty, entered into a partnership with Microsoft Research to do a small pilot in Dharavi, in Asia's biggest slum, right? So, when we did the pilot, it was very obvious that women would not open SMSs, that voice calls work, SMS wouldn't work. Also, we realized that, yes, women listen to the calls. So we went with that results of the pilot to the skeptical NGOs, showed them those results. And eventually we got, funding for a randomized cluster trial that showed impact, right? So slowly, by proving impact, we got the NGO partners to come on board. Same thing with hospitals, right? We enrolled women in the hospitals and in the slums. With the hospital, we started our, my alma mater has been very kind. They have agreed to pilot my crazy ideas. So it is the first hospital where the program got implemented, and it really showed impact. Other hospitals, were all happy to come on board. That's how you prove impact through small pilots, yeah. And it spreads.
That's very interesting. When you went to some of the big NGOs and the multilateral agencies, did you not think, if I present the idea and they can do it, they've got this massive scale, they've got these networks, they've got funding, they've been in the area for so long. Do you think about that?
I was really focused on creating homegrown NGO. It is very important that the solutions came from the ground up rather than, top down, because if I had to go to an alternative, at the same time that I was thinking of M-Mitra mobile, M-Mitra means mobile Mitra, mobile friend. Obviously, there were other entities thinking of similar solutions, right? So there was a Mobile Alliance for Maternal Action, which eventually came and funded us in India, right? And BBC was thinking of, a similar program in Bihar. It is very important that a homegrown Indian NGO does it, because why should it not be an Indian NGO doing it, correct? Why it has to be always the big multilateral agencies? Also, when an Indian NGO does it, it's far cheaper, So look at Indian Arman Solutions. They're far, far cheaper than any multilateral agency doing it. Also, we have the talent in India, right? India is not a country where there's technology. India, you know, is the technology back office of the world, right? So we have the tech knowledge in India. We have the medical knowledge in India. So why not do it ourselves, right? So why always piggyback ride on, you know, big multilateral agencies? And even for them, it's easier to fund us, right? So that's what happened eventually, right? When we, when Mitra was, piloted, the RCT funding, when I started doing the randomized cluster trial, I wrote the trial, and it got funded by DFID UK. And then Mobile Alliance for Maternal Action, a big multilateral, agencies consortium. You know, it came on board and funded the scale-up of Mitra, right? So they came in and funded us to scale up our program. So it is always, why not do it ourselves?
And that's very interesting what you say. Now, also, I know you wrote a piece quite recently and talking about this question of technology. And I think one of the main ideas you were presenting is that the innovation is not so much the technology, but how technology is deployed.
Yes.
Clearly, you've been on a journey here. You talked about even at the early stage, recognizing that text messages weren't going to work.
Yes, it's about technology assisting a program, not tech alone, right? It's tech plus touch model. You can't have tech alone. You know, you have to have the touch point, right? But the touch point is through our health workers enrolling, our hospital supervisors in the hospitals, our call center. So tech plus touch model works. Tech alone would not work. That's one very important point. Second point is that you use the technology to suit the needs of the women on the ground, right? It's not about, you know, I have a solution that's technology based. Now women have to change their habits to suit that technology. So if you look at how our programs work, right? So if you look at our voice calling services, so we have, we have a voice call. We don't have an SMS because women do not know how to open an SMS, read an SMS. A voice calls also have that emotional connect, right? So that's why it's a voice call. Secondly, we didn't expect women to pick up the calls more than 60% of times because, you know, there's connectivity issues, etc. So, you know, we created the voice calls in a manner, the content is created in a manner that there's redundancy, you know, so that we, a woman will end up hearing almost all the information she needs to hear, even if she picks up 60% of the calls, right? So then we also had a time slot choice because, you know, not everybody has their own phone, right? So, but the family has, so she can ensure the phone is with her. So she can give a time slot when she can ensure that phone is with her. Right, then we have also had 3 tries for every message. In Kilkari, there are 9 tries for every message. Why do we do that? Because if she doesn't pick up one day, maybe she can have access to it the next day. Then we also have a missed call system. Why? Because if she's missed all the 3 tries, she can give a free missed call and the system will call her back. Right? She doesn't have to pay for that missed call. And again, a call center, because eventually you need to really speak to somebody. Right? So if you look at how we've devised the program, it actually seamlessly integrates with her needs and her compulsions in her life, right? It doesn't ask her to kind of, change her behavior. We are adjusting to her. That's how, that's why technology, innovation is not in technology because, it's easy technology. It's not hard technology. Yes, at scale, it's hard technology. We're talking about our voice platform. We're talking about, millions and millions being served. Of course, this is new territory. But having said that, at the end of the day, it's technology that people can build, but all of these, methods in which we employ to reach the women is where the innovation is.
That's very interesting. What about your own, developing your own platform and as an organization using technology within your organization?
We have done that. If you look at Mitra platform, it's our own. So we have our own tech team, and along with that tech, we also have a few vendors, right, who we work with in collaboration. So if you look at the Mitra platform, it's our own. If you look at, and so we've done that. So what we do is, where we need to kind of, we don't like to reinvent the wheel. It's already existing, we will use that. But certain places we find when we create our own platform, because when we created Mitra, there's nothing existing there. So we had to create our own platform, and it's cheaper to do it that way.
Right, right. But what have been the biggest challenges, would you say? Are there one or two other big challenges that you've had to face?
Absolutely. I mean, firstly, building an organization. I mean, I need to start from the very beginning. I'm a doctor. I didn't get trained in how to build an organization, right? And also, there's no link between, in India at least, there's no link between clinical medicine and public health. So actually, how do you even build an organization? How do you even farm registration to actually getting funding, you know, and convincing people? So it was a very hard journey I learned along the way. So every point was a problem, right? And fundraising was a huge challenge, right? Because those times, we really didn't, 2006, 2008, there were really no, you know, big CSR funds available, nor were there organizations that, you know, help you raise funds. So it was very hard. 4 years it took me to get the first funding. And fundraising obviously remains a challenge for any NGO along the way. Now we are in a better situation, much better. In Armana has, you know, scaled up so much that there are donors who are happy to come along on the ride. But it's always a challenge, right? So then also technology, right? So, you know, I'd come from a medical world, no tech experience, obviously finding the right tech partners, finding technology, trained people to join the organization, because tech people wouldn't want to join an NGO. Obviously they want to join a tech company. How to build that team inside, how to keep pace with technology changes, right? Because if you realize technology, you know, changes so fast, and that you don't want to get outdated, right? You don't want to be, you know, in the past, right? So your beneficiaries have moved ahead and you're still stuck in the past. You don't want that to happen. These are some of the challenges that we are facing. Also, obviously, you know, a talent, right? So you want to, you know, you're building an organization that is innovative, right? Because in this space, we have being the ones, you know, working innovatively. So to kind of get the right talent that appreciates that, comes on board and learns, you know, newer ways of doing things and not traditional models, obviously is always a challenge.
Yes, yes. You mentioned building an organization. I mean, as you said, your background's medical background, but you weren't trained in business or organization. What kind of support have you had on your journey as a social entrepreneur?
So initially, it was very difficult because, as I said, I didn't come from public health nor social work. So I didn't have the networks initially, right? I was a doctor and I was a student at that, right? Now, I mean, if I had founded Arman now, at least I would have access to networks, at least because I'm already an established doctor. But as a student, I didn't have access to that. So it was very difficult. So initially, support came from few, you know, friends, actually, you know, in terms of, you know, many people signed up as trustees. At least there was this moral support, right? And when I was in Stanford, I built Arman USA, and I'm very thankful to those, you know, Stanford students. Many of them came on board, from India, Indian students in the US, and some Americans came and joined Arman USA team. Obviously they didn't know anything much about the space, but I think, they trusted me and believed in me, and they came on board. So initially, and having those people coming on board, yes, of course, it didn't give me access to funds, but at least there was moral support that, yes, people are supporting you, right? So, slowly, obviously, started entering competitions here and there. Obviously, it took a long while before it came to a point where, at Saving Lives at Birth event, we were noticed in 2011. Eventually, we have organizations like DASRA, which have come on board. DASRA is like the, you know, they are the organizations who kind of helped capacity building of, you know, NGOs working in the field. So they came on board to help us. And some of our donors, I'll talk about it later on, really helped us grow because they saw, believed in us. And eventually after 4 years, when the support came in, funding support came in, those are the, you know, entities that really helped us.
Yes. Were there any moments where you thought, this is too much, I can't do this?
No, because, I'm called a social entrepreneur now. I didn't set out saying, oh, I have to become a social entrepreneur. It was a problem I wanted to solve. So if you keep your, focus on the problem, and you keep thinking that everything I do now can make the life of a woman or child better, eventually, you know, your problems don't seem big, right? So at no point did I ever feel, oh my God, look, I'm facing so many issues. You have to really believe in the solution. You have to believe in yourself. 4 years of not having access to a single penny is not really an easy ride, but also doing it along with my fellowship, right? I had a very exhaustive fellowship in Cleveland Clinic that I was doing. I mean, morning, 6 o'clock, evening, 7 to 8, I was in the hospital working and then coming back home and burning the midnight oil. So it wasn't an easy ride, but I think when you know that this has to be done, it has to be done. And I think what I managed to do was that I had the vision, but then, you have to be able to break the vision down into simple steps. Because, there are so many steps to that vision. The day-to-day working of it is not easy and not even interesting sometimes, but you have to do it. And so, I think that perseverance has to be there. And that perseverance came from the passion and the fact that eventually, hopefully, this will help somebody.
Can you maybe talk about your approach to partnering? What have you learned about partnering and any observations about what it's like to partner with the Indian government?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are two points to scale. One is technology, another is partnerships. You can't achieve scale unless you have partners who come on the ride with you. There is no way. I realized early on that you cannot create a parallel infrastructure. Because if you look at traditional models, it depends upon creating health workers, right? So you go into a particular area and you kind of create your own cadre of health workers who go home to home and to give services. But that never scales up. And it is very obvious to me that already in the field, there are so many wonderful NGOs working for 30, 40 years, doing phenomenal work. But because they are resource intensive models, they can't scale up. And it is very obvious that if I partnered with them, you know, we can actually not only scale up the programs very well, but also help them scale up their programs. I'll give an example, right? So if you look at in Mumbai slums, there's Mankut slum or there's Dharavid, some of the biggest slums in Asia, right? So there's a wonderful organization called Apnale, which is working in Mankut. And obviously because of scale up problems, they were covering, you know, maybe one third, half of Mankut. But when we partnered with them, with M-Mitra, they could spread to other parts of Mankud, right? Because when you use M-Mitra or voice calling service to give information to women, it takes over the voice counseling task of the health workers. So the health workers could prioritize to other work, right? Because counseling was taken over by M-Mitra. So we could complement the work of the partner NGO. So this has happened, you know, in multiple cases, right? Where the partner NGOs feel that M-Mitra is taking on a big chunk of the difficult work that they're doing of going home to home and raising awareness. So they could focus on other aspects of the, you know, maternal child health caregiving in the field. So what I realized about partnership is that it has to be a true partnership. It can't be a hierarchical partnership, right? You have to value your partner. You have to complement their work. They have to see value in the program that you are, coming to them with, that it will help them in their own work. And then they ensure that, you know, then the partnership stays for long. So we've literally, some of the partners we've had for 7 years now, and it's wonderful, the partnership, right? Secondly, same thing with hospitals. So we enroll women in Mobile Mitra in the slums through NGOs and hospitals, right? Because women come to the hospital for care. Now, again, in the hospitals, they really support them. Why? Because, when M-Mitra has taken over their counseling services, they can focus on caregiving, right? So, and the hospital is so happy with the work that actually our health workers who are stationed in the hospitals have their own room to enroll women. They've actually integrated in the system of the hospital. So it's, this has happened over so many, over 90 hospitals over the last 4-5 years. And the partnerships still continue. Why? Because they see value in it. So partnerships depend on value addition. It depends upon complementary work. It depends upon respecting them as equals and not as, a hierarchical sub-grantees. That's how it all works.
Presumably, as you build a reputation, as you've proven yourself, as you've got scale and impact, it's easier to build partnerships. How was it at the beginning? Was it challenging?
Absolutely. As I told you, then there was a lot of skepticism whether the program would even work. But I have to thank many of the initial partners who came on board that they really, and of course, and I must tell you this, right? We were the new kids on the block. When we went to the people for NGOs already existing for partnership, some of them were existing last 30, 20 years. Right. And so, I must thank them that they saw value in what, we had gone to them with, because we were just 2-3 people in the organization then. Right. To go and say that we want to do this program, we want to, create scale. It must have sounded foolish. Right. But some of them believed in us. But yes, we had to prove ourselves at every point. Right. And also when the NGO partners have their health workers on the ground who we incentivize, we would financially incentivize them to enroll women into the program. M-Mitra program, the voice calling service. So when the health workers would go home to home, initially they face resistance, right? Because suddenly when you go to a woman saying, oh, there's a voice calling service, they're going to send you information on the phone weekly. And these are women who've never talked to anybody else on the phone except their husbands or their mothers-in-law. Of course, they're not going to listen to you, right? So even the initial, acceptance from the beneficiaries was very difficult. So the NGO partners had to believe in us that this would actually take off.
Can you talk now about Kilkari, the partnership with the Indian government? How did that come about? And maybe, I know you've grown, but still partnering with the Indian government is quite something.
Yeah, so I tell you, Kilkari came to us because we did Emitra very well. Emitra was our flagship program, the first voice calling service that we started off with. And just to tell you what it is, it's twice a week in pregnancy and twice a week in infancy, literally, we send voice calls in the chosen time slot and language. And we have three tries for every message. We have a missed call system and we have a call center. Right. And, you know, Emitra got spread across the country, right? 9 states, 2.3 million women, you know, because I told you that the way we employed the technology was suited to how the women, you know, accept it or what they need in the ground. And so it spread across. And the government of India noticed the success. And, you know, they had a program, similar program called Kilkari. Kilkari is in 13 states. And Kilkari is similar, but the number of voice calls are lesser than Emitra, 73 voice calls, and once a week. And they needed new partners, and they needed to come to need a partner who knew how to implement such programs. And seeing the success of Emitra, they came to us, said, why don't you take on Kilkari? And, you know, very early on, I told you the pillars of scale are, one is technology, second is partnership, third is government. You can't scale through the country unless you work with the government health system. You know, you know, Emitra is funded through donors, right? Everything end to end. Yes, it's very cost effective. It is so cheap that in less than $5, a woman can get Emitra for 2 years of her life. But imagine when you partner with government, when government takes over the voice calling costs, government takes over the enrollment of women, because the enrollment is happening through the frontline health workers of the government of India in each village of the country. It is less than 50 cents for us per cost, our cost of it per woman, 25 cents maybe. Why? Because of the fact that it's 24 rupees, you know, so it's 72 rupees is $1, right? So it's less than 50 cents. So it is, you know, the best thing to do to if you really want to scale up. But yes, government partnerships come with their own difficulties, because, you know, it's very hard anywhere in the world to work with any kind of bureaucracy. But I must tell you this, there are wonderful people sitting in the bureaucracy there. Who want the best things to happen, right? So, but of course, systems are so difficult even for them, right? To, you know, scale up a program like this. So if you really work hard, like we realized after working with the government that the principles we adopted for working with hospitals and working with NGO partners works with government also. You really have to respect them. You have to really push it. Of course, you can't sit on a high horse and expect them to come to you. You really have to push it. If you want some program, because we took on Kilkari and Mobile Academy, our program to, you know, augment them also, right? Improve them, you know, and spread through the country. So you have to go to the government. You have to work with them. You have to run behind ensuring that the permissions come in. But if you're ready to really do that, you know, persevere and do that, do all that is required to make it work, the government see that, right? The partnership is going very well.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Very interesting. Finally, a big topic I've touched on a little bit, the whole question of fundraising. You mentioned clearly at the beginning, yes. Very challenging at the very beginning when you're making the case. So once you started to get a little bit of funding, how did that go? And who is funding you primarily? And what have you learned about the fundraising process?
Absolutely. So what did I learn about fundraising process came from, you know, really the partnerships that grew along the way with funders. Right. Yes. First 4 years, absolutely no funding. In fact, the first funding that came in through social media. I did a Facebook campaign. I got my first $10,000 and I got $4,000 around from, you know, a small, you know, home NGO in the United States called Indians for Collective Action, you know, Bay Area, you know, Indians. But after 4 years, DFID UK had this whole grant that they came out with. Which was Global Poverty Action Fund. And, you know, we won that grant. You know, we were one of the eight, that's the first funding we got in for implementing, right? But before that, 6 months before, and this was in 2013, but before that in 2011, we had come to the final round of the Saving Lives at Birth event. Saving Lives at Birth was this huge consortium of global donors who came together to kind of, you know, have a competition. And we came to the final round. And there, we won the People's Choice Award. We didn't win the, you know, grant, but we won the People's Choice Award. And I got to speak in front of a very august audience after 4 years of really running and knocking on all doors. And in the audience was, I must take this name, somebody called Alice Fabiano. You know, she was really, you know, one of the initial supporters of Arman when we were just three people, you know, we were just a prototype, right? She was J&J Global Contributions. J&J has this global contribution, which is apart from the corporate structure. It is basically a, you know, foundation that helps scale, you know, the scale programs through the world, right? So they were in the, and she was in the audience and she heard me. And J&J Global Contribution is a part of MAMA. There was an entity called MAMA earlier, Mobile Alliance for Maternal Action, a consortium of UN Foundation, J&J, USAID, Baby Center, and mHealth Alliance. So they had a consortium. They had funded a program similar to this in South Africa, which is a SMS-based program, actually. And then they came to Bangladesh, and they were going to come to India. And, you know, I must say that, you know, when they came to India, she heard me, she remembered having heard me on stage. And though we were so small and we were just beginning to implement this RCT, randomized trusted trial in rural Maharashtra with DFID funding. And also we were doing a small program in my own alma mater with funding from a CSR, corporate social responsibility support from a company called Glenmark. And I really thank Glenmark here, you know, for having seen, you know, how, you know, the pioneering this program was. They came in to fund a small pilot in my alma mater. And then when they came to India, MAMA came to India, Mobile Alliance for Maternal Action, they actually funded the scale up, right? So Emita really grew through the country, 9 states with MAMA support. And then going forward, you know, I must take the name of Tara Trust. Tara Trust came in to support our other programs. So J&J, Tara Trust, MAMA, and then slowly, we started getting in corporate social responsibility support, right? So different companies came on board to support us, right? But 2019, things changed, right? So I'm very happy to say that we, through a very rigorous process, we won the SCOLE Award. So 2020 SCOLE Award, we won. It was a whole 1 year's process. And we're the only NGO from Asia or Africa to have won SCOLE Award this year, right? So when we won the SCOLE Award, and SCOLE is a very prestigious, you know, entity, and we got exposure. So, you know, then, you know, LGT is another donor from Switzerland, and then RippleWorks from the United States, all have come on board and are supporting us now. So now we're in a place where, you know, people are realizing that, you know, this kind of work needs to be supported, that technology enabled solutions are the way to forward given COVID. So right now our funding, you know, stream is far easier. Yeah. And the lessons I learned was, I must tell you, is that, you know, what I learned along the way is absolute transparency. Never hide your problems. Treat your donors as partners. You know, so we hide nothing from anybody. Because, you know, at the end of the day, either the woman who's going to, you know, if you hide problems, if you do not, you know, talk it out, you know, openly what's happening, you know, at the end of the day, who's going to suffer is the woman on the ground, you know. So we always are completely transparent. We ensure that we, you know, hire the right talent and support them to flourish. And we have systems in place, because if you don't have systems in place, donors do not have the, you know, confidence in you. So we really have worked hard on building systems in place in the organization and hire the right talent to manage. And so capacity building has been a very big initiative for us, so that, you know, donors have the, you know, confidence in us and they'll come and, you know, support you.
Fascinating, fascinating. What advice do you have for other social entrepreneurs on their journey, Aparna?
Yes, you know, never give up, persevere. And I mean, 4 years, and the first 4 years, you know, I didn't even know if Arman is going to happen. You know, but you keep at it, you know, like Steve Jobs, you know, that speech he gave, that connect the dots, you know, eventually everything connects, right? And my whole life story of building Arman is testament to that, right? If you persevere, you never give up. You know, it happens. But also have a vision. If you look at Arman's, you know, the vision didn't develop along the way. You know, Arman's vision of using technology, of having Tech Plus Touch, using existing networks, you know, scale solutions, cost-effective solutions, they're already in place before the first program got implemented. We designed solutions like that. So you have your vision in place. You know, you can't discover vision after you start an NGO. You should know what you're going to do. But also you should have the ability to break it down into pieces. You have to work out the details, right? You know, you need to know, you know, the next step towards the entire whole, right? Collaborate, hire the right talent. You know, you really need to do that, because, you know, I'm very worried about founder syndrome. Yes, I put my heart and soul. I don't earn from Arman. I put literally till 4 years ago, 5 years ago, everything I earned went into Arman, because how do you fund, you know, even a prototype, right? So, so you really put your heart and soul into it. But at the right time, you have to hire the right talent, right? Because I'm a full-time doctor. I spend a lot of time on Arman, but you obviously have to have professional leadership. So, you know, you need to be able to hire the right talent, give them that, you know, support, and empower them, you know. So you really have to invest in team building, and then the team has to come on and really believe in the, you know, in their vision, right? And that will happen only if you give them ownership. So you have to let go. So you need to, you know, you literally have to, you give birth to your child, and the child grows to the teenage years, and then you have to let go, you know, and you need to know when to come in. And, you know, so I'm very involved with Arman, but Arman, and the thing about Arman is that, you know, and that happens with every NGO, right? Every organization, that when you grow, you have so many other talents you need, right? Get those talents in and give them that power.
That's fantastic advice and hard won over the years. What's next for Arman?
Yes. So I must tell you that, as I told you, on the one side, we have these voice calling services. And on the other hand, we have, so along with Kilkari, we have got a partnership with Government of India to implement Mobile Academy. Mobile Academy is a mobile health based training program for frontline health workers. You know, it's right now like a voice calling service. Women call in and 11 chapters, 4 hours of content and bookmarking system. They can log in and log off. So, you know, both our Kilkari and Mitra on one hand, and our mHealth based teaching program for, you know, frontline health workers are currently voice based services. So going forward, one very important thing we want to do is, in addition to scale, right, both Kilkari and Mobile Academy will scale through the country, right? Our goal is by 2025 to reach across to 45 million women and their children and train 1 million health workers, right? So Kilkari and Mobile Academy will scale across the country. But mMitra will become the sandbox for the same, right? So mMitra will test innovations that will get scaled through the country, through Kilkari and Mobile Academy. That's our whole hope. What we want to do on the voice calling services side is to build a pyramidal structure. So mMitra and Kilkari for everybody, but, you know, women with high risk factors, children with high risk factors. So for example, we have a malnutrition program, right? So, you know, we send voice calls to every pregnant woman, mother with child. But if a child develops moderate acute malnutrition, we have more handholding for their mothers to prevent them from getting severe acute malnutrition. So we want to go into this creating more focused programs for high risk factors and using two-way communication, using WhatsApp, using a thin app, you know, that doesn't take much data, right? So have more focused programs focus on these high risk factors. So that we, you know, all women are served and all children are served according to the needs of those women and children. So on the one hand is that, of course, keep pace with technology changes. We are already doing a WhatsApp pilot. So on the one hand, that is that, improving the technology that we're using and doing two-way communication. On the one other hand, offer health worker training, because almost 30 to 40% of frontline health workers now have access to smartphones. We are going to go into, you know, more multimedia training approaches. Training through WhatsApp, hand-holding through WhatsApp, call center services, so that, you know, we can have more hand-holding. They can learn through videos that they send them, or is, you know, put into the thin app in their on their phone, right? And we have remote training that we can do, right? And we can also have call center services and WhatsApp services to handhold them. They can call back in for any query, or they can message us for any query. So having more two-way communication with the women on one side and the health workers on the other side is our major goal. Lastly, imagine the kind of data that we deal with, right? Kilkari and Mobile Academy are the largest such programs in the world. Talking about every woman and every child in the country whom we want to serve, right? So literally 30 million million women are delivered every year in the country. We are hoping that we will reach at least 15 million per year in next five years, right? Per year, 15 million we want to serve. Imagine the kind of data, right? We want to do predictive analytics to be able to create targeted solutions, right? Both for voice calling service like Kilkari and for our, health worker training program. And towards that, we've already entered into a partnership with Harvard and Google, right? So we have a partnership with Google right now where we use artificial intelligence to analyze our data and to create predictive models. So we already done that with the listenership. So when we send voice calls, some women do not, listen to the calls, right? So there are these low listeners, women who may drop out. How to predict which woman will drop out so that we can ensure that we can get her back into the system, right? Or we can have other programs to deliver care to them. So we actually, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me here. We can predict based on 2 months of listening, who's going to drop off. And then we are actually calling them up to ensure that they know of the service and they remain committed to the program, right? So we are going to use artificial intelligence for all such, you know, all our, or I'm predicting analytics for all our programs to be able to create targeted programming. Eventually, you know, what we are dreaming is that, you know, we, Kilkari and Mobile Academy, and also we want to go into the auxiliary nurse midwife, right? The nurses need to be trained and the medical officers need to get trained. So, you know, we're going to go into that too. So eventually all of that will become, you know, one platform. So on the one hand, we have Kilkari, and the other hand, we have the health worker training program. Imagine they're integrated. So imagine a situation where, you know, in a part of the country where malaria is a huge issue. On the one hand, we can create targeted programming to, you know, inform women there about malaria more. Or we can, on the other hand, on the health worker training side, we can train the health workers there more on how to take care of malaria. So we can create a targeted programming is our goal.
Well, it's a tremendous vision, vast scale and activity. And I wish you the very best of success with all of that, Aparna. Thank you so much for taking the time today to talk about your work, for your sacrifice over the years, your commitment and passion.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur podcast. I hope you found this interview inspiring. Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com and subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts.